This is The Rotunda. I'm Tramell Gomes.
I'm also disappointed that Bill Nelson, a senator from Florida, voted against funding last week.
Governor Rick Scott gets political over Zika funding, but Bay News 9's Troy Kinsey says his tactic backfired.
Now you've got a number of Republicans who are second-guessing what the governor's been saying, especially on the Zika issue and about Bill Nelson in Washington.
While promoting his new hotel in Washington, Trump reignites the birther issue.
President Barack Obama was born in the United States, period.
When it comes to land conservation, there's the ongoing debate between government-owned and privately-owned land.
The more government owns the land, the less land there is to tax, and that means the less revenue for local government.
That's property rights expert Dan Peterson on finding the right balance here in Florida. All that and more, including Jeb Bush's cameo at the Emmys.
Jeb, exclamation point.
This is episode 76 of The Rotunda. Well, our politicians here in the Sunshine State really do know how to work the media. Well, not as good as Donald Trump, the king of media manipulation, but some of our once public, now private citizens know how to keep themselves in the spotlight. First up, former Governor Jeb Bush is poking fun at himself with Jimmy Kimmel at this year's Emmy Awards.
You're a lifesaver.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, you're driving?
Yeah, I'm in between jobs right now. You know, you can make $12 an hour driving for Uber.
Imagine that, Bush as an Uber driver.
I have to get downtown to the Emmys.
Are you nominated?
I am, yeah.
Wow, what's that like?
It's nice. It's nice.
You think you can win?
Well, there's a lot of competition, and probably not.
Well, here's what I know. If you run a positive campaign, the voters ultimately will make the right choice.
You know, it's funny you say that. My sidekick...
Jimmy, that was a joke. Get out of the car.
It's nice to see Jeb loosen up and have fun.
And shave that wig off your face, you godless Hollywood hippie. Jeb, exclamation point.
Full of energy with that exclamation point. Now to soon-to-be former Congresswoman Corinne Brown. She was on the radio waves on the Tom Joyner Morning Show ahead of this weekend's festivities at the Black Caucus Foundation in Washington.
And my favorite Congresswoman, Representative Corinne Brown, is on the phone. How you doing?
Oh, and my favorite show, number one in the United States.
Thank you.
The information to African Americans.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'm so sad that you lost the election, and you've been serving for how many terms and how many years?
It's 34 years, and I've been in Congress for 24.
Wow.
24. And before we talk about the conference, on the line is my attorney, James Smith, who is a graduate of Hampton.
All right.
All right, James, say hello.
Good morning, Tom.
Brown brought her attorney on the show to encourage all of her supporters to give back and help her fight fraud charges. Imagine that.
And one of the things that we want to emphasize to everyone today is that she's fought for them so hard for all this time, and now is the time we certainly need their help.
As you've heard here during the coverage on the Rotunda, according to federal prosecutors, Brown and a staffer presented the nonprofit One Door for Education as a scholarship fund, but instead used its finances as a personal slush fund. Brown supposedly used the money to pay off back taxes and fund public events honoring herself. However, she vows to fight the charges to the end.
Your other lawyers wanted you to settle, and you said, I am innocent. I
oh,
will
no,
not
no.
Settle.
We're taking it all the way to the end. No, let me tell you something. When you're born, you get a birth certificate, and when you die, you're going to get a death certificate. And your name, that dash in between, is what you've done to make this a better place. I am not going to let people destroy my name.
And now to the man who knows how to work the media. Donald Trump did it again.
President Barack Obama was born in the United States, period. Now we all want to get back to making America strong and great again.
Trump managed to get all of national media to publicize the opening of his brand new hotel in Washington. Oh, by the way, he single-handedly closed the chapter on the birther movement.
I was pretty confident about where I was born. I think most people were as well.
Yes, President Obama, but Donald Trump had a lot of support questioning where you were born. Trump even blamed Hillary Clinton for starting the movement, which is false.
For 5 years, he has led the birther movement to delegitimize our first black president. He is feeding into the worst impulses, the bigotry and bias that lurks in our country.
While on Meet the Press, Republican National Committee Chairman Reince Priebus admitted that he too helped carry the birther movement, while vigorously trying to point fingers at Hillary Clinton for one of her staffers' involvement. But Priebus also used his moment to make things a lot more difficult for Republicans who are in the Never Trump camp.
It would the party itself penalize somebody who does not make good on the pledge that they made to support the party?
I think these are things that our party is going to look at in the process. And I think that people who gave us their word, used information from the RNC, should be on board. I mean,
John
you want
Kasich?
To take part in a process, sure.
Governor John Kasich. So if he wants to run again, seems like he might want to, he might be out of luck as far as the RNC goes.
Well, I look, people are in our party are talking about what we're going to do about this. I mean, there's a ballot access issue in South Carolina. In order to be on the ballot in South Carolina, you actually have to pledge your support to the nominee, no matter who that person is.
So in the case of Jeb Bush, Ted Cruz, and John Kasich, who recently said Trump should apologize for the birther issue, if each of them don't fall in line with the party, they will get penalized if they try to run for president again. So what would you do if you were Ohio Governor John Kasich? What an unusual position to be in. Or is it unusual? As Priebus stated, you have to toe the party line if you want access to party resources. But does this risk pushing more Republicans away from their already fractured party? This is The Rotunda. I'm Tramell Gomes, taking this moment to invite you, yes, you, to go the extra step with your support of this program. We are listener-supported, and you can make your financial contribution to The Rotunda at rotundapodcast.com. This program is unique. We make politics your business by getting up close and personal with the people and issues shaping Florida politics. Coming up, you'll hear from Bay News 9's Troy Kinsey and think tanks like the James Madison Institute sharing their latest research on government versus private land ownership. This is The Rotunda, where everyone gathers in our very own public square to exchange ideas, hear various views, and stay informed. Thanks for your support. Now, the Zika crisis continues here in Florida, and Governor Rick Scott at first seemed to have called on everyone in Washington to take the high road and keep politics out of the need to send funds to Florida in order to fight the spreading virus.
I'm here because it's time for politics is over. Time for political debate has passed. The time now is to pass Zika funding.
But while expressing frustration from congressional inaction, he lashes out on his likely 2018 opponent.
I'm also disappointed that Bill Nelson, a senator from Florida, voted against funding last week. He turned the back on Floridians.
Here's what Bill Nelson had to say about his vote.
Zika doesn't have anything to do with the Confederate flag, and Zika doesn't have anything to do with defunding Planned Parenthood.
To help break down the politics of it all, I caught up with Bay News 9's Troy Kinsey. We're hanging out in the plaza-level rotunda of Florida's capital.
Well, a couple of big issues. You've got Governor Scott, who went to Washington, D.C. and railed against Bill Nelson. Mm-hmm. He said Nelson, quote, turned his back on Florida by voting against a Zika funding package that denied funding to Planned Parenthood. Well, guess what? That attack flopped among Scott's fellow Republicans. You've got Ileana Ross-Lakeman now accusing Scott of blatant partisanship. You've got Marco Rubio, who didn't call Scott out by name, but did praise Bill Nelson and said he thinks he's doing a fine job on the Zika issue. And I think a lot of this has to do with the politics of 2018, the fact that Rick Scott widely expected to run for the U.S. Senate, and he's trying to get digs in at Bill Nelson now. Well, for all intents and purposes, those digs backfired this week among Scott's fellow Republicans. And by the way, there's a lot of talk around the halls of power about there being a Republican challenger or two or three to Scott if Scott were indeed to run for the U.S. Senate. A lot of people out there say it's time to turn the page on Rick Scott and are thinking about challenging him in that 2018 U.S. Senate primary.
Why hasn't he done his homework with regards to getting some allies and support, like from his own party,
because
striking out on things?
Because in large measure, he doesn't need it, right? He's got tens of millions of dollars, and let's get to work. So he's got the support of the business lobby. He's got the support of his political benefactors. And he thinks, a la 2010, a la 2014, he can do it again. He can buy another election that way. And he might well be right. But as it stands right now, you've got a number of Republicans who are second-guessing what the governor's been saying, especially on the Zika issue and about Bill Nelson in Washington.
All right, Troy Kinsey with the update. Thank you.
You bet.
So the congressional wrangling is still ongoing. Governor Rick Scott has allocated an additional $10 million to the already $26 million in state funding to deal with the Zika virus. Republican Congressman Carlos Corbello says Florida lawmakers are continuing their work to get federal funding.
We're here together, Republicans, Democrats, all Floridians, calling on the Senate to act, which I understand that they will very soon.
Now here's a topic that always sparks debate. It pits environmentalists against budget watchdogs because it has to do with figuring out just how to make conservation profitable. Some would argue conservation is profitable in the long term because we're able to live and maintain our natural ecosystem in a way that we can continue to live off the protected land. But there are a lot of people spending a significant amount of research in hopes to strike the right balance, and one such person is Dan Peterson, Director for Property Rights at the James Madison Institute. He joins us now to share his findings.
It's the thing that has made our country the most exceptional and the greatest country, I think, in history. This right for individuals to own and to use private property as they deem best.
So, Mr. Peterson, what do you do exactly? What's in the scope of your role?
I'm interested in working anything that has to do with the use of private property and anything that might infringe on that, reduce the use of that. You know, there are, when we talk about property rights, there are generally speaking five areas of property rights, and people refer to those as a fistful of property rights. One is to own and possess your property. One is to use your property. One is to enjoy your property. One is to exclude others from your property. And then finally, is to dispose of your property. And so when government regulations or local ordinances begin to infringe on that, then, you know, we want to look at that. So that's a pretty broad and big issue. Another issue that is related to that is just the establishing a balance between government-owned land and privately owned land.
Where are we in the debate between private-owned land and government-owned land?
For those who may not be aware, the states west of the Mississippi, many of those states are more than 50% owned by the federal government. And I think it's in Utah that it's something on the magnitude of 85% to 87% of the land is owned by the federal government. Across the board, in any given state, the government owns on average about one-third of the land. And in Florida, that is actually true. That I would say it's probably around 30% of the land in Florida is owned by government. That could be federal government, local government, or state government. Number one, the people that take the best care of their property and their land are private owners. And I've heard people tell stories about the difference between government-owned land and its maintenance, and then how private properties take care of their land. And the legislature in Florida has really worked since the advent of Amendment 1 to put more money towards the maintenance of the property that they own, and I think that's a great idea. Here's one of the interesting situations. When the government owns the land, it's not taxable. And so the more land, say, in any given county, the more of that land that is put into either conservation or for one reason or another owned by the by a government, it's not on the tax rolls. And so it reduces the taxes from property taxes that are used to help fund schools and to help, you know, repair roads or build new roads, all kinds of things like that, repair infrastructure. And so when, for instance, in Utah, if the state government only has access to 13% of the land because the federal government owns 87% of it, that puts enormous pressure on state legislatures to put a budget together, to use their land wisely, and they have to even get subsidies from the federal government so that they can keep a balanced budget.
So you're saying when it's in private ownership, it's more beneficial for the state because it remains on the tax rolls?
Yes. And the land, it remains on the tax roll, plus there is an economic expectation or advantage to that land because for instance, the state can own conservation land, but it just sits there. It produces nothing. Whereas if land is maybe put into a conservation easement, but it's a farm or a cattle ranch or something like that, then it's not just paying taxes, but it's actually generating income because it's being a part of our statewide economy. It's generating revenue, and that's good for our state.
Can you quantify what the state has lost in recent years from purchasing private property?
I don't have any numbers on that. Every given county would be able to probably quantify that number because, you know, every county has a property appraiser. That is the basis for property taxes. And then, in any given county of Florida, our 67 counties, the more government owns the land, the less land there is to tax. And that means the less revenue for local government. And of course, the choices would be, in that case, either property taxes have to go up to pay for current services provided by government, or the government would have to back away from certain government programs in order to make those budgets balanced. And we all know that governments are not in the habit of wanting to cut back on any programs, and so it's generally going to mean taxes have to go up. And I know recently in Orlando, Florida, taxes went up 13 to 17%. It was quite an increase in a given year. So it's something that the private owners ought to be aware of, and especially at the county level, because it's their property taxes that are going to be affected most.
What's been happening recently? How much land has been purchased by the state for environmental conservation and restoration purposes?
I don't have the number on that. In recent years, there has been less land purchased. Part of that was due to our economy, and since 2008, 2009, when the economy was really tanked, you know, our state legislature and every local government realized that there was not the luxury of buying more land. Now, what's interesting is a couple of years ago, I began to talk to state legislators about how much property is owned by the state and by the federal government and then, you know, other local governments. And most of those people, when I would talk to them, they would say, well, we think 5 to 10% of our state is in government ownership. It turns out in Florida, almost 28% of our land is owned by government. And people were shocked. And those in the legislature began to ask the very wise question, well, how much land should government really own? And have we reached a place where we need to be much more selective? And if we have to buy land, what is its purpose? And I'm not negative about a government purchasing land when it's necessary. But if it's not necessary and we're just trying to save land and keep it in conservation, I don't know how much that is a good idea, especially in light of the fact that our state is approximately 27% in conservation right now.
You know, it makes one wonder what else could we do with the land when purchased for conservation. Looking to the state's famed Florida Forever program, which is part of what led to one of the best park systems that we all enjoy, what's your assessment of the program and how it's done over the years, as we know it's lost some funding.
Well, very much so. And I think in the initial stages, and I was not a Florida resident at the time all of that took place, but the Florida Forever program, you know, was designed to protect property and keep it in conservation, to sort of protect our state and its interest in the agrotourism industry and things like that. And that's fine if that's the direction the state wants to go into. But there comes a point where we need to think through, is this really what we want to do and how we want our state to operate? So I know with the advent of Amendment 1, environmentalists really had in mind that this was going to be a huge fund from which to buy property. The state legislators, however, our legislature recognized that amendment did not say the purpose was just to buy property or to acquire land. It was also to provide maintenance to already owned properties. It was to restore areas that needed restoration, such as the Florida Everglades, for instance. And so since that time, they have released less money towards Florida Forever for actual land purposes and more towards land maintenance. In other words, let's really be good stewards of the property we already own. And we shouldn't buy more if we can't take care of what we have currently. Where we have a real purpose and a need for purchasing property, then I think that is something that should be debated and considered, and the cost should be counted to the taxpayers. You know, recently I wrote a paper, a research paper for the James Madison Institute called Solving the Everglades Riddle, and that is, how do we go about restoring the Everglades? And in some places, there is a need for government to purchase land to build facilities that will help control the flow of water and also help protect the quality of water here in Florida. And so when purposes like that are out there, there is a need, that's a public need, to take care of an issue. But if it's just let's randomly buy property so that we can put it in conservation and protect it from development, then I'm not sure that's the way we want to go in Florida.
You're listening to Dan Peterson, Director for Property Rights at the James Madison Institute. Speaking of the Everglades, incoming Senate President Joe Negron has proposed what some environmental groups have been demanding for some time now, which is to buy land to create new reservoirs for water storage. And he's proposing purchasing land south of Lake Okeechobee to assist with Everglades restoration. You've written a paper on this, but for our audience, what do you make of this proposal?
Before I wrote the paper, which is, by the way, on our website, jamesmadison.org, Solving the Everglades Riddle, I actually toured that whole area down there and talked to a number of people from different perspectives as to what needs to be done. And for those who are unacquainted with the issue, the federal government and the Army Corps of Engineers controls Lake Okeechobee. And the dike that has been built around Lake Okeechobee has certain limits. When the water gets to a certain level, water has to be relieved out of that lake to protect its integrity and prevent any kind of flooding. And the water is, some people who are aware, the water therefore is released through canals into the St. Lucie River to the east and the St. Lucie estuary, and then to the west it goes through a river called the Caloosahatchee River, and it ends up emptying in the area of Fort Myers. And of course, it's been in the news that these huge releases of fresh water, when they collide with the brackish and salt water, and they have some high nutrient contents in it, it leads to these tremendous algae blooms that have been devastating to local economies and the marine life in those estuaries and even along the coast of Florida. So that's the issue. The issue has therefore been, how could we build reservoirs to capture that water and control its flow into these estuaries, as opposed to just overwhelming amounts of water being sent in there? Most of the people that I have discussed this with have felt like land is owned and the best place to buy land would be north of the lake, so that a lot of the flow from the Kissimmee River that flows into that lake could be controlled better and controlled not only in terms of its quality, but its quantity. Also, people say that it would be best to build these reservoirs between Lake Okeechobee and the estuaries to the east and to the west. All of the land, of course, to the south of Lake Okeechobee is in the agricultural area, and that is where a number of agricultural interests exist, because the land is and has been so fertile there for decades now. And, of course, I think the environmentalists seem to be often interested in not just buying land, but, you know, they would like to see many of those agricultural interests vacate that agricultural area. I want to commend Senator Negron, because he led the fight for a piece of legislation called Florida Legacy, where I think $200 million a year out of Amendment 1 funds was going to be funneled specifically into that issue of how do we control the water out of Lake Okeechobee. And that was a good thing. Now, actually, reservoirs are needed around the lake, so there's no question about that. And he made a decision that he said, let's start south of the lake. A lot of people I talk with have more of the perspective, you know, if you walked into your kitchen one night and you saw the water was on and your sink was about to overflow, would you cut a new drain in your sink to empty the water as it flows in, or would you try to control the water coming into your sink? And I think that's maybe a good illustration of why it would be strategic to try to capture water either before it gets into the lake or definitely before it gets into these estuaries to the east and to the west. The people with whom I had discussions about this were more favorable towards going to the north of the lake and then east and the west. And, you know, I'm not the expert. I'm not the scientist here, but that's what they would advise. I don't know what kinds of discussions Senator Negron had and with whom, but that was a choice he made. So that's what's going to be discussed in our next legislative session.
That's Dan Peterson with the James Madison Institute. That's it for this edition of The Rotunda. Special thanks to Troy Kinsey with Bay News 9 and Dan Peterson with the James Madison Institute. Remember to visit rotundapodcast.com and join us again next week right here for more stories about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. I'm Tramell Gomes.